Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
The curtain of night is drawn back. The telescopes are trained. The domes are open. The audience is set. Now, step into the event horizon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the event horizon here on Astronomy.fm radio. That means we are now live. My name is Marty Coons with my co-host.
Good evening. This is Nicky Vetch, 2 Echo Zero, Lima, Uniform November. And if you are in GMT, oh my God, it's early.
Yeah, about 2 o'clock in the morning, Universal Time, December the 2nd, Saturday morning. So that means for us here in the eastern portion of North America, that means it is December the 1st, 9 o'clock in the evening, 2017, Friday night for us. And, of course, we have our chat room open and ready for you to come on over and join us. Just go to the homepage, astronomy.fm, and you'll see where it says radio chat. Click on that. That'll get you to log in. Type in any name you want to. And, well, be reasonable. And then hit log in. You'll be here in our chat room. If you want to ask us astronomy questions, feel free to do so. We will attempt to answer them live on the air right now. We will at minimal say hi to you when you come on into our chat room. So right now we've got you and me, of course.
Hi, Starstorm. Nice to see you.
Aquafew, Glenn, Cassie. Yes. We had, who was here earlier?
Akon? Akron.
Akron, yep.
I gave him the link to get the radio slide.
Yep.
So
came in a couple hours before showtime, and so fortunately we try to catch people as best we can in between shows and stuff like that, so off hours. So hope you're listening in and got a chance to connect with us. And the Frozen One just dropped in. Glad to have you here. So great, people are coming in.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about stuff. What do you want to talk about?
All kinds of stuff. Star stuff, which is, we're all made of star stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what anybody says. Sagan really, really did hit the nail on the head with that one simple sentence. We are all made of star stuff.
And pre-star stuff.
Yeah.
Didn't think about that, did you?
Well, things you got to remember. Most people don't go beyond the regular universe. They don't go into the subatomic, the quantum universe.
Mm-hmm.
It's the macro universe. It's the universe we can see, that we can touch. So it's really a case of, if I can touch it, if I can see it, if I can smell it, therefore it's real.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Glenn, I'm not going to repeat that comment. But yeah.
You just said most of us are full of.
Yeah.
Star stuff. There you go.
Yeah. So, like I say, it's really a case of a lot of people really don't go in for what they can't see and sense with what they've got. But there is other parts of the universe. And I honestly think we are going to get a grand unified theory of everything, because it's going to be the theory that ties relativity, special relativity, general relativity, and quantum mechanics together. There is a theory out there somewhere. Somebody is going to find it. And you know what? That will eventually tie everything together. Of course, the big thing is tying in what happens in the quantum universe into what happens in the universe we know.
Quantum means really small, by the way. Extremely, extremely small.
We're going down to subatomic levels here.
Uh-huh.
This is the very basic building blocks of the universe. And I think that's also where we're perhaps going to figure out why the galaxies clump together and what is trying to rip everything apart and what causes the universe to expand. How far it's going to expand, we are never going to know. Certainly not in this lifetime. And I really do wonder how long it will be. Perhaps generations.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get there. But we're going to get there. And you never know. It may even give us a completely new level of physics that will allow us to perhaps eventually, if not totally beat light speed, but certainly tweak it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say we won't know how long it'll last in this lifetime. Well, maybe it is possible as equipment gets better and better, research gets better and better, we may get some of those answers in this lifetime. I mean, we won't see the end of the universe ourselves.
I have to say, Mike, at this point, I am so glad I am not wearing a red shirt at this moment. The red shirts always... I feel sorry for red shirts because they get the worst part of the mission, the away team missions. They get to look after us types in our Command Gold and Science Blues. And they also have these wonderful targets painted on their foreheads, their backs, their wherever. So,
That's red shirt security, though, not red shirt officers, usually.
So. Yeah, I know. Well, there's only about two officers who have survived an away team, a planet-side mission. And that's always been Scotty, and it's always been Uhura.
Mm-hmm. Wearing red shirts, you want to say?
Wearing red shirts, yes.
Yep.
Because that tends to be the engineering color as well. I think it's the actual logo on their shirts that really does it, because engineering is a completely different logo, and I believe communications are a subset of engineering anyway.
Mm. So, I know the exact reason why red shirts always lose it, though. The exact reason.
Okay,
one word.
What's the exact reason?
Writers.
Yeah, true. Writers do like to have somebody they can kill off in a show.
That's right.
Okay. Talking about writers, here's a little known fact. It's completely nothing to do with astronomy.
I agree with Starstorm on this one. Go ahead.
There's nothing to worry about. Do you know that there were actually two members of the MASH cast who served in Korea?
The MASH cast?
Yes.
That served in Korea.
Served in Korea, for real.
For real. Let's see.
No Googling, Marty.
No, I'm not Googling. I'm thinking Harry, what's his name?
No, Glenn's got it. Alan Alda and Jamie Farr. They were there after 1953, but they did serve in the U.S. Army in Korea.
Oh, well.
Just an irrelevant fact.
Okay. Yep. Now, guess who actually served in Starfleet? Nobody.
Apart from you and me.
That was easy. Yeah.
dear. But, you know, as I say, it's just one of those interesting things. Scotty was Jamie Doohan, was actually in the Canadian forces. And what people don't realize, he actually lost a finger in the D-Day landings.
Mm-hmm.
And he still continued as his unit sniper, as the unit sniper for his team, and survived the war.
I don't think I ever noticed that on the show.
No, you don't. Because they were very careful. He always had a glass or a book or something in his hand.
Think there'd be a couple of slips, though, once in a while.
No, they got very, very good at working around it. Apparently, Roddenberry was determined that he wanted Jimmy Doohan in the role. He wanted someone who could do a proper Scots engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy was his man. But saying that, Bill Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, where did they first turn up? The Man from U.N.C.L.E. in the very first episode, the Vulcan effect.
Interesting.
And if you watch the episode, you will see the way Napoleon Solo escorts Bill Shatner, a drunk Bill Shatner, out of the party.
Okay.
And then they pan back to Leonard Nimoy standing there, and it is the classic Spock shot.
Yeah.
Side onto his face, it is the classic Spock shot. Yeah. It's good fun. But, it's kind of nice. If it wasn't for Star Trek, I don't think a lot of us would actually be here doing astronomy, because, to be honest, there are so many people at NASA, at ESA, who say, how did you get involved in astronomy? How did you get involved in astrophysics? Star Trek, it was the thing that brought everybody in and gave them the dream to explore space.
Yeah, I got in there before Star Trek. I mean, I think I remember Echo flying over.
Yeah, satellite.
Remember that mission? Basically, it was like a giant balloon up in space, and they could bounce radio signals off it. That's why it's called Echo, and it's supposed to fly over. I don't remember if I actually saw it, but I do seem to remember being brought outside to look at it.
I think the thing for me, it was, I would say 1967 maybe.
Okay.
That's when I first started. I started watching The Sky at Night at a very young age. It would be repeated on BBC Two in the afternoons on Saturdays. Obviously, it went out live at around midnight on Friday, and there would be a recording of it and repeated on BBC Two. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I got starting watching this show, and I think the other thing that really got me into astronomy was Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But particularly after when the second Doctor came in, and he started having adventures off planet, and they started moving away somewhat from history. Then that really fired my imagination. I liked the idea of being able to. There's a message from our radio producer.
Okay.
The Echo passes were printed in almost all the newspapers for a while. Remember newspapers, Marcy? But as I say, it was science fiction that got people into the sciences, into astronomy. And I totally blame James Burke. I blame Sir Arthur C. Clarke. And I totally and utterly blame Patrick Moore. Because he would be in the studio, he would have these terrific diagrams done by Paul Doherty. And it was like, it explained everything that was being said. James Burke would do a show about the American space program, and he would ask the questions, and he would produce these brilliant ideas. He would leap from point to point to point. He took you along. It was a case of really dragging your mind into the whole thing. And of course, who better for the first manned moon mission to have in the studio at BBC than Patrick Moore, James Burke, and Arthur C. Clarke. Now, Arthur had also been writing science fiction. Yes, Optronics. He was the one that did everything in the three Connections series. Into Connections 1, 2, and 3. All of them pretty much the same basic thing, but they went into different things in different periods of time. He had the ability to make you want to pay attention, to make you want to learn. And, of course, Arthur would write stunning science fiction that postulated man on Mars, man exploring the solar system, man on the moon, man living on the moon, tourist buses crossing the moon to show tourists the historic sites and the beauty of Earthrise. They literally, in some respects, fueled our appetite. And then, of course, in the 70s, Sagan did the original Cosmos. Mm-hmm. Now, I give Neil deGrasse Tyson full credit. He did a really, really wonderful reboot of Cosmos. I just think using animation and actors to voice animation was perhaps a bit of a letdown. I really liked seeing perhaps human actors, live people, doing the reconstructions. Now, as I say, I have issues with some of the choices for voices because of some of the attitudes that the voices have in real life. I'm not going to go into that unless I'm really pressed to. But having said that, I think that deGrasse Tyson did such a wonderful job. He brought it alive. His thought spacecraft, where he did the journeying through the cosmos, was brilliant. It was a step beyond Star Trek. it was beyond, I think, most of the science fiction we knew about traveling in the universe. He didn't rely on Dan Dare. He didn't rely on James T. Kirk. He brought the thought experiment back to life. He gave it a real rebreather. He resurrected it. The last people who really successfully did thought experiments was Einstein, Schrödinger, because they couldn't measure physically what they were postulating, what they were talking about. But they gave it such a life, such a vivacity, that when you followed the thought experiment, you could understand where they're going from and what they're doing. It made it understandable. It allowed you to perhaps appreciate the thought experiment about having a cat in a box. In one universe, the radiation emitter is opened, or the poison is opened, and the cat dies. Whereas in the other universe, the cat doesn't die. He explained how the experiment worked, and it allowed us to really, really understand what was going on. Now, Einstein, wrote in German, because he was German, but it was easy to translate. The translations were not ambiguous or flawed. People took the time to really, really make sure that when they did the translations, that it was accurate. And that way we could understand what was being said. I've watched maybe two or three different courses on general relativity. And a lot of the time it falls down because it's really a case of they don't take the effort to get into his mind. It's dry facts. They don't explain it. Now, if you really want a good book that's going to take you ages to read, there's a book by Kip Thorne, Space, Black Holes and Time Warps and Stuff. I'll ask Starstorm, would you do me a favor? Yeah. There's a book on my bedstand by Kip Thorne. Could you just grab it for me, please? Thank you. This has taken the thought experiment to a new level. He starts off with a thought experiment, but it's written down, and it's explained clearly, lucidly. And it really, really does allow you to get into the whole of the science. Thank you. Okay, the book is Black Holes and Time Warps, Einstein's Outrageous Legacy. It's by Kip S. Thorne, with a foreword by Stephen Hawking. And even the Wall Street Journal had to admit it was an engrossing blend of theory, history, and anecdote. Now, if you really want to get into physics, into astrophysics, into quantum mechanics and stuff, this is the book to read. It was published by Norton, and Kip Thorne is the Feynman Professor of Theoretical Physics, emeritus at the CIT, and he also wrote with John Wheeler and Charles Misner, Gravitation. And he was the 1994 recipient of the American Institute of Science Physics Science Writing Award. So it is part of of a great series of books it's the Commonwealth Book Fund program that published it, with the assistance of the Rockefeller University, who administered the program. If you really want to be able to get your head around physics, and particularly Einstein's relativity, this is the book to get and to read. I think I'm on my second reading of it. I'm about halfway through it right now. Mm-hmm. And as I say, it was really a case of I read it, I got most of it, put it aside for a month or so, and I went back to it and I started reading it again. And each time I've read the book, it really brought it home what was going on, and it made it more and more easy to understand. I suspect it's probably going to take about 10 or 12 rereads before I can really say I've got my head around it. But you know what? Until you... Good book does that. Thank you, Starstorm. But until you can really do that, you will... Yeah, you might get the basics of it, but it, once you've done it and you've spent the time... I'm actually looking at for copies now of the translated original manuscript for by Einstein. I want to read the original. Yes, in English, I don't speak or read German, but I want to get a copy of that. I want to read it myself, and I want to so I can actually finally say, yeah, okay, I get what you're saying.
That's assuming the translation is accurate enough. Cause definitely
well, yeah, that's
translations it. Are up to interpretation.
Now, Red Shirt number 3 says, Kip Thorne also wrote The Science of Interstellar. Yes, he did. And you know what the really great thing is? It helps you to understand relativity and relativistic speeds, especially around black holes, particularly around the event horizon. Sorry, I had to get a plug-in for the show.
Don't really need to because we're here already. So.
I know, but you know what? It's really nice to mention the show's name on the show. But seriously, there are some pretty good translations out there. Read what people say about the copy.
Now, one problem with Einstein's theory is that people generally can't relate.
Go on, Marty.
There you go. Say what?
You said something and then you went,
I said the thing about Einstein's theories is that generally people can't relate.
They can't because the one way to relate it is to look at a speeding car.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going at roughly the same speed, it appears to be standing still.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're standing still and watching it, you can also appreciate the Doppler effect as well. You can then understand why things go from blue to red and why how the sound changes as it approaches and goes away from you. It is a way of understanding and seeing science in motion. No, I didn't probably catch that pun, Marty.
I said people generally can't relate general relativity.
Most people really can't, in all honesty, because they don't have perhaps the foundations to appreciate it and understand it. Glenn, yeah, you're right. Nothing actually really stands still. We're moving through the universe at an X amount of speed in relative to everything else. We're not exactly standing still. The Earth is rotating at a set speed. We're moving through the solar system at a set speed. So, no, we're not. Even if you stood still on the face of the Earth, you are not really standing still anymore.
Well, you're not even standing still no matter what you do.
Yeah, I agree. You don't need the math to understand Einstein, but having the math to perhaps appreciate it in a deeper sense is nice. I think the first time we actually did a show together, we did something on black holes. I did a presentation, I think, on why 42 is the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. Do you remember that, Marty?
Uh-huh.
Quite a while ago. I had a course from Dr. Alex Fipanenko on black holes. Now, Alex is a very good guy. He can make the most complex thing seem fairly understandable. And he shows the math in the course that proves that at that time, the Large Hadron Collider, yes, it may produce a mini black hole. But guess what? The event horizon of that mini black hole is so small, it starves. Mm-hmm. It has 42 minutes of life because it can't feed. And then it goes poof into a mass, into Hawking radiation. So yeah, they can make these mini black holes if they want. Unless a black hole can feed, it can't grow. So, and I think we touched on that last week in towards the end of the show about with two black holes that merge together
mm-hmm.
To form a bigger black hole.
It's more black hole stories tonight too.
yeah, great, let's do some. But as I say, I was never very good at maths. Now, having said that, I can sit with a calculator and I can do a simultaneous calculation, which my math professor said was like, yeah, right, prove it, Yvette. And I did. Because that time I was learning to be a life support technician for the oil rigs, and you have to be able to do simultaneous equations to work out how much gas you need to keep divers alive for X number of hours at X pressure, i.e. at the bottom of the North Sea in a habitat. So normally they have a nifty little thing called a Scion organizer that is programmed to do the calculations. I didn't have a Scion organizer in the course. I did have a calculator. And I would work out each part of the equation in sequence and then put it all together on paper. And I handed my answer in to the course instructor. And it was a case of like, ah, and he says, why? What's the problem? Well, your answer is actually pretty much dead on. So it works. It can be done. You can learn. Even people like, I am 54 years old. Do you know what? I'm still learning. Mm-hmm. And I'm enjoying it so much.
A question in our chat room says, well, at the equator, we're traveling at about 1,000 miles an hour as the Earth rotates at that speed at the equator. Why don't we break the sound barrier? Because it's relative to the sound barrier is relative to the medium that you're actually moving through. So, for instance, the astronauts inside the capsule are moving at 17, you know, orbiting capsule are moving at 17,000 miles an hour, but so is the air around them. So, same thing with the Earth. If you're standing on the Earth at the equator, not only are you moving at 1,000 miles an hour, but so is the air. Mm. That's why you don't break the sound barrier at the equator or anywhere else. So, if you carry your air with you, you don't break it. But if you move through that air, at say 750 miles an hour, so yep, then you will break the sound barrier.
Well, that's what we have aircraft for,
right?
And if you want to do it without an aircraft, you need a whip.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch some of the rodeos, they have the whip contest to see how many times you can crack the whip in mm-hmm. a set time period. That piece of leather is actually breaking the sound barrier.
Yep, that's. I think so.
It's crazy. It's crazy when you think about it, but it is quite true.
I have to look it up again, or else it's just another one of those urban myths that's not quite true. I'd have to check it out again. Now, if you're on the Earth moving around the sun, by the way, I can't remember the galactic stuff, but on the Earth moving around the sun, you're traveling at about 65,000 miles an hour. Now, depending on where you're at on the Earth, if you're on the equator, and you're on the meridian, the midnight line, by the way, then you could add an extra 1,000 miles an hour to your speed. By the way, if you're standing and the sun is on the meridian and you're standing at noontime, you actually deduct 1,000 miles an hour from your orbital speed. So in 12 hours, we change our speed by 2,000 miles an hour. Nobody thinks about that. Then I don't remember the numbers for actually orbiting the galaxy. I'll have to look that one up.
Well, everything is moving relative to everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing is, we don't really notice it because we think we're moving slow. And it's perception.
Yes.
End of the day, it is perception.
Yep.
Because you think, oh, I'm only walking, 2 miles an hour? Mm-hmm. I'm going pretty slow. But we're not. Everything mm-hmm. else is moving in relation to it. And that was what one of the things Einstein was trying to get over with his paper, that we're not as we think we are, but we are actually moving at a different rate, comparatively speaking. Mm-hmm. As I say, physics is brilliant. So much you can do. There's so much fun you can have without blowing up a laboratory or your house. But it's all good fun. Now, I'm just going to put a quick shout out to Black Projects because we know he's missing tonight. So we are missing you, get yourself sorted. Come back next week because we like your links.
I'll say hi to everybody else that's in chat room too. We got you and me. We've got Aqua for You, Glenn, Cassie, Starstorm, the Frozen One, Redshirt Number Three, and Optronics. All welcome to Event Horizon on Friday night. It's now about 9:30 in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. So that means we're halfway through our program. Still got another half hour to go. And don't forget, coming up after the Event Horizon, we've got more programming for you to listen to. Three more hours, and we'll repeat everything in 4-hour blocks for the next 24 hours. So keep tuned in after the Event Horizon is over with, too. More programming.
And of course, the really great thing is with AFM, you get the links. If you're listening to the repeats to the podcasts, you get the links on our website. So you can actually see what we're talking about and understand. Yeah, okay, we're getting told off, Marty. We're not putting enough links in chat. Come on, let's put some links in the chat.
Well, we need to talk about stuff that's linkable. Otherwise, we'll be talking about the missing links.
Yeah. Missing link, isn't that with Lucy? That's somewhere else.
Something like that, yeah. Well, let's see, we got a launch coming up.
Entirely. Not astronomy. Yeah, I'm getting told off for the joke.
Next week, December the 8th, there will be a launch of a SpaceX cargo mission to the International Space Station. And coming up soon, there's supposed to be, another cargo mission is actually going to depart from the space station before that on December the 6th. So lots of missions to and from the space station coming up. So keep an eye on those things. Keep an eye on NASA TV for actually watch some of that stuff, too. Haven't seen a separation from the space station yet. Want to, or an attachment, too. It always never seems to be the correct orbital period for anything like that. So, used to see the space station and the space shuttle fly around together. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, space shuttle. Yeah, flying brick. Not as cool as an Apollo command capsule. Was it Ryan? Might be, should Lockheed Martin actually get their fingers out and get the thing operational, built, tested, and certified. I think this is perhaps where we're falling down, folks, in the US, is that the people building all our hardware and then dinging it, like Boeing did, I believe, with a set of fuel tanks for SLS, is the fact that it always goes to the big defense contractors. I really think it's going to be Elon Musk, it's going to be Steve Bezos, and all the new guys on the block that may actually be stealing the marches.
Have you seen this blue picture of Jupiter?
No, I haven't. Let's have a look at it.
Check at it. There it is.
Jupiter's got the blues, huh?
Yeah, there's so much detail in it that the more you look at it, the more you actually see just swirl after swirl after swirl. And also, when you look at this picture, think about after you look at it, it's going to be pretty much gone. Those swirls don't stay there. They move around. They dissipate. They change shape. So once you get one image of swirly Jupiter, then it's gone a little while later. So.
Well, the whole of the Jovian atmosphere is one perpetual storm.
Mm-hmm. Storm now, and swirls and whirls and swirls, however you want to call it.
Well, they're saying that the spatial scale in the image is 7.7 miles to a pixel.
Mm-hmm.
12.5 kilometers to the pixel.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when Juno was at a latitude of 57.57 degrees, nearly three-fifths of the way from Jupiter's equator to its north pole.
Yeah.
On the ninth flyby. Now, let's see. Oh yeah, see here's one. Let's go for this. So since we're doing Jupiter, we're going to go back in a little bit in time to November the 9th, okay? Yeah, what can you do in astronomy? You can time travel.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so Jupiter's stunning southern hemisphere. Okay, so actually it's part of that as part of the earlier picture you shared, Marty.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at it, this is actually showing the southern hemisphere, and as It captures one of the white ovals in the string of pearls, one of eight massive rotating storms at 40 degrees south latitude on the Jovian sphere. Now, this picture was taken on October 24th as Juno performed its ninth close one. At the time the image was being taken, the spacecraft was about 20,577 miles from the tops of the clouds at a latitude of about -52.6 degrees. Like I say, every pixel is something like 13, maybe 14 miles across. That just shows you the actual scale of this. And one other thing that caught my eye, well, there's two other things that caught my eye on this set of images from Juno. The great red spot. When you're looking at 12 kilometers to the pixel, what we're actually seeing in detail is kind of brilliant. Okay, great red spot. Everybody's seen it. It's probably the most thing that drags your eye when you look at Jupiter through a telescope. So that is it in true color. So this is a storm. It was created. The image was created by citizen scientist Bjorn Johansson, mm-hmm. using data from the JunoCam imager on Juno. Now, this is a natural color rendition of what the great red spot surrounding areas would look like to human eyes from Juno's position. You can see the tumultuous atmospheric zones in and around the red spot. They are very clearly defined. So this is back from an image taken on July 10th on its seventh flyby. So the other thing, some of the things that caught me was this one here. And this is a Jovian moon shadow on the planet. Okay.
Now, this red spot one's kind of far away, I think, isn't it? And it's going to be much closer another time.
As I say,
a couple more flybys, and it'll be really close.
Yep, they are moving the space probe closer and closer mm-hmm. to the planet for each flyby. So there, a nice Jovian moon shadow, and I know that Glenn and I have seen these live when we've been using remote telescopes. So this is Almathea casting a shadow on this particular part of the gas giant. Now, the elongated shape is obviously a result of both the location of the moon with relation to Jupiter, as well as the irregular shape of the moon. So this is an image back taken on September 1st and the 8th close flyby. And at that point, the spacecraft was only 2,397 miles from the tops of the Jovian clouds. So again, this just shows you how stunning and how brilliant some of our tech is these days. I would love to be eyeballing this myself, but I would probably be dying in about 20 minutes afterwards mm-hmm. from the radiation.
Yeah, so like our technology is really not that great. So it's just a robot view. So, you know, when it's really great technology, that means you're sitting next to the planet looking at it. That's great technology. We're in baby steps yet.
Well, all civilizations take their steps out into their own native solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And we are definitely doing that. We've made the big announcement that we're out there with Voyagers 1 and 2, with Pioneer. All exiting the solar system. We have radio signals which are getting out there and probably announcing, hey, everybody, we are a nasty, violent species. Come and avoid like the plague. Yeah, don't come and play with us because we play rough. Now, one last image I really want to share from this collage of Jupiter. And Io and Europa are casting shadows. They're not casting shadows. They're actually shown as moons against the red planet, the beautiful reddish-orange color of Jupiter.
Yeah, it's called a transit.
It's a transit, yes.
In the telescope, yep. Jupiter is still in the morning skies, very morning skies, rising at a little bit, somewhere right around 5:30 in the morning for Northern Hemisphere observers. So that's still pretty far down there, but like I said, get your observations in. You never know when the next rock's going to hit the surface of Jupiter. Well, the cloud tops anyways.
Well, yeah, we've had Shoemaker Levy 9, my favorite. we've had Anthony Weasley's event. We've had Chris Goh's imaging event. Really, in some respects, this is something that seems to be happening on a very much on a regular basis. The fact that we've got lucky and caught it now three times in a row.
Regulars, relative. Nobody's seen that happen in hundreds of years. Now we got a couple of them. I don't know if that's regular or not.
Well, when you consider that we never, up until Shoemaker Levy 9, we really did not know about these events. Mm-hmm. We had a mysterious light splatter line of craters on a couple of Jupiter's moons. Now we know what caused them. Mm-hmm. Probably a comet that had been ripped to shreds. And instead of impacting on Jupiter this time, it actually impacted on one of the moons. We see something similar here. There are crater chains which could well have been impact sites from a disintegrating nucleus.
Mm-hmm.
And I think really it was Shoemaker 11-9 that explained this, that gave us the, wow, this is what happened.
Well, gave us an example of what could happen without actually analyzing the material of the crater. You don't really know if it's cometary material or asteroidal material.
Yeah, but the thing is, now we have a very good idea of what is the cause. And we never had that before. It was a puzzle.
It was something broken up just before impact. Because that's basically all you could say. Whether it's comet or asteroid, don't really know.
Well, I seem to remember that David Levy and Gene Shoemaker actually realized that what they'd been seeing on one of Jupiter's moons was an impact of an object that had been ripped apart by Jupiter.
Yep.
And had actually hit the moon instead of the planet.
Yep.
Now, for a long time, they didn't know what it was. But then it was like a major clue by four, watching the impact of Shoemaker Levy 9.
Mm-hmm.
So, it really, in some respects, what did it do for us? Well, it woke us up that there is stuff out there that, if it does manage to hit us, could be fairly lethal. Thank you, Starstorm.
Mm-hmm.
That it does happen. We're now currently overdue for such an event. Having said that, we now are tracking a lot of, we are now looking for stuff that could hit, and we are now tracking it. We're now able to give stuff like this orbits. So we have a situation now where we're aware. Thank you, Starstorm. Isn't this fun? Having somebody sitting beside you, giving you the perfect words to use, and you can all hear it yourself. But yeah, it is. We're living in really good. We're living in a good technological age because we have the instruments. Amateur astronomers have instruments which are as good, if sometimes not better, than the professionals.
Mm-hmm.
We can do things that the professionals only wish they could. We can we can actually dedicate months of imaging, of tracking to objects. We can follow variable stars.
We can look through a telescope while drinking beer.
We can do that too, Marty. I'd prefer to have a glass of wine, if you don't mind, old boy. Clink.
There you go.
Oh, dear. So Red Shirt 3 thinks Marty and Starstorm are sharing a brain. Now, that's a scary thought.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, the nice little article I found whilst I was talking. Yeah, clink, Glenn, clink. The nice thing about being a snow zone astronomer, you can either use a remote telescope or you can run a cable to your telescope, sit indoors, have a nice glass of wine, and watch the universe on your computer monitor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, asteroid 3200 Peyton, Geminid parent at its closest and brightest. December is the time of the Geminid meteor shower, and 3200 Pythaeon is about to make a historically close flyby. Get ready to watch it race across the sky.
And don't panic!
Exactly. Know where your towel is and your babelfish. I've been asked to put a Hitchhiker's reference in earlier this evening. There you go, Starstorm, it's done. And it's 42. So, we have a fantastic opportunity to see a unique asteroid brighter than it's ever been observed. It's the size of a rural hamlet, a village. It will pass within 10.3 million kilometers from Earth at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on December 16th. Just before closest approach, it will reach a whopping magnitude 10.7, bright enough to track in a 3-inch telescope, and I do mean track. Hold on to your eyepiece. This thing will be scooting along at up to 15 degrees per day, or 1.6 arc minutes a minute, fast enough to cross the field of view like a slow-moving satellite. There is a nice little diagram that gives an overview of the flight through Auriga, through Capricornus, in the next few weeks. It's changing phase, is shown throughout. Numbers beneath the phases are visual magnitudes at the time. One reason the asteroid fades so rapidly after closest approach is because its phase narrows to a crescent from our perspective. The asteroid's size is not to scale. So, it's got a perihelion distance of 0.14 AU, or less than half of that of Mercury. If lead melts on the innermost planets when the temperatures reach 800 Fahrenheit, 427 Celsius, Pythaeon has got it beat by a mile. Its scorched surface tops around 12,000 Fahrenheit, hot enough for lead to flow like water and aluminium turn to putty. So it gets
plastic.
Well, if it's plastic, it's melted. So it gets roasted by the sun every 524 days. It also explains its other claim to fame as the parent of the Geminid meteor shower. Shortly after it was discovered on October the 11th, 1983, along with the orbiting infrared telescope, IRAS, Fred Whipple noticed that Peyton's orbit matched that of the Geminids, clinching it as the shower's source. Most meteor showers originate with comets. When a comet gets near the sun, solar heating vaporizes dust-rich ice off the nucleus, and the push of sunlight radiation pressure blows it back out to form a coma and tail. The ejected material forms a trail or stream along the orbit, and when the Earth slices through that dust, it slams into the atmosphere and vaporizes. Particle by particle, we got a meteor shower. So, how do you get dust from an asteroid? Early hypothesis, now discarded, thought that Peyton might have ice underneath its surface that vaporizes. Well, that would have made it a comet. Daleks don't like the smell of beer. That I wouldn't know. They are totally fictional. I hope totally. Okay. Now, they thought it had ice underneath the surface that vaporizes around the time of perihelion. It sounds plausible. Measurements show that the asteroid gets too hot for ice to survive inside or out. Still, you might get blood from a turnip if that turnip is composed of carboniferous carbon and water-rich minerals like our friend is, and heated to a temperature high enough to cause the material to break down, crack, and crumble into dust. So, perhaps this was once a traditional comet. Well, no longer. Today, it is considered a rock comet, a rare type of object that outgasses rock particles instead of ice. So, when you pour boiling water on cold glass, the glass shatters from thermal shock. Similarly, extreme solar heating at the time of perihelion will cause rapid expansion of the crustal rocks. They fracture and release dust that's carried away by the radiation pressure of sunlight, which also means this could be a way for a leisurely voyage in the inner solar system, solar sails. And I know the planets Jasati are working on solar sail too. So experiments have shown that the dust particles are about a millimeter across, which is approximately the size of the Geminids. So it is pretty much a fairly good fit. We now know where the Geminids come from.
So Phaeton, even though it's not heavy metal, but it still rocks.
It still rocks, yeah.
Right.
But you never know when something's going to jar that discovery into oblivion.
Yep. Things, science moves on. It takes a theory. It runs with it for a while. Oh, yes, this works. Uh-oh, suddenly it doesn't work. Why? Because we probably got better ways to measure stuff. And
Or
something happens that allows us to have a better insight. So, as I say, for now, we have the theory that this is a rock comet. The stresses are making it crumble. It gives off material. The solar wind streams it, and we pass through it, and we get a nice ice. We get a nice display in the sky. I totally agree, Redshirt 3. Comet ice is dirty, and why ruin good scotch? Having said that, if it's only a blended scotch, I'll let you off. Hey, did we? You know what's happened, Marty? We've been so busy, we never did the bottom of the hour station high tent.
I did.
You did?
I did.
I didn't hear you.
I know, but I did it.
Anyway, so the last decent display was 2009. What was the last perihelion? And we got a surprise doubling in the asteroid's brightness, probably due to one of these gritty outbursts. Questions still are there. Meteor showers requires constant nourishment. Every time Halley's Comet comes back, its associated meteor shower gets a nice big injection of material. So we're going to be seeing. So not only will Phaeton be brighter than ever, its appearance coincides too much with the December 13th and 14th peak of the Geminids. It's a rare pairing. Let's have some fun. Let's go look at it.
Well, at least we're having a full moon right now. So in a couple more weeks, we'll be right around new moon. Definitely a good time to enjoy some Geminid meteor showers.
And you know what? Get out of the city. Pack up. If it's a weekend, drive out. Go to your local state park area where there's probably going to be a lot less light pollution. And enjoy these things.
Mm-hmm. So we've got a little article on the, what's it on? It's on the Andromeda Galaxy.
Yeah.
It's, well, just astronomers some time ago discovered a black hole in the Andromeda Galaxy. Well, now it's two black holes, and it's way beyond the Andromeda Galaxy. Let me put that article into our chat room right here. Mm-hmm. They're calling it, you'll see this pop up in news items, that the Andromeda Galaxy was photobombed by a pair of galactic black holes. Now, these are big black holes, massive black holes, the kind that you would find in the center of galaxies themselves, and they're orbiting around each other. So they're got some X-ray output and some optical output, and it was just recently that they discovered that this pair is actually about 2.5 billion light years beyond the Andromeda Galaxy, which is easy to see in the early part of the evening, though, by the way. So if you get outside and pretty much almost high overhead, you'll be able to see the Andromeda Galaxy coming off the northern corner of Pegasus, the winged horse. So go look for Pegasus and Andromeda, and then try to think that, well, there's a couple of giant black holes right there. And what else we got? Oh, speaking of black holes, recently discovered right around our own Milky Way black hole, 11, count them, 11 brand new stars. Yeah, called protostars. And they're not even completely formed into stars yet, but they've been detected to have high-velocity jets coming from them. And surprisingly, though, that they're actually fairly close to the galactic black super black hole, only a distance of 3 light years away. What's confusing about that is that you wouldn't think with all that gravity around that black hole that there would be enough stability to bring gas together into clouds and form them into stars themselves, because usually the black hole just tears everything apart before it gets in. So it's actually quite close to the black hole. kind of a surprising discovery. And you can read that article. Again, it's kind of all over in the astronomical publications. So check that out. All right, got about 5 more minutes. Where do we want to go now?
Stellar motions in a nearby galaxy.
Stellar motions? We can go with stellar motions in a nearby galaxy.
Okay, so the story is that stellar motions in a nearby galaxy hint at underlying dark matter. The sculpted dwarf galaxy, pictured in a new image from the Wide Field Imager camera installed on the 2.2-meter MPG ESO telescope at La Silla, is a close neighbor of our galaxy, the Milky Way. Now, what they've done, for the first time, the three-dimensional motions of individual stars in the nearby sculpted dwarf galaxy have helped astronomers shed new light on the distribution of invisible dark matter that pervades the galaxy. This study combined the positions of stars measured by ESA's Gaia mission with observations from the ESA NASA Hubble Space Telescope taken 12 years earlier. Now, our galaxy is home to hundreds of billions of stars. It's orbited by more than a dozen smaller satellite galaxies. The best known of the swarm, obviously, is the large and small Magellanic Clouds, and they are visible from middle to southern latitudes to the naked eye. So is Andromeda visible to the naked eye if you've got really good conditions and reasonable eyesight.
Yep.
So,
Have powerful
binoculars, I agree. So what they've been doing, they've been studying the stars in the dwarf galaxies for decades, striving to reconstruct their origin and to uncover the past history of our galaxy and its environment. Now, the study has brought one of these galaxies into unprecedented focus. For the first time, we've been able to determine how individual stars are moving through a dwarf satellite of our own Milky Way. And this is from David Massari of Capitan Astronomical Institute in Groningen, the Netherlands. And he's the lead author of the paper published in Nature Astronomy. Now, this is possible because we are combining the exceptionally accurate measurements of stellar positions from Gaia's first data release with equally outstanding observations taken over 12 years earlier by the Hubble. As expected, the shifts in the stars' positions, as observed on the plane of the galaxy called proper motions, are tiny, even over the long-time baseline between 2002, when the Hubble observations were performed, and the first set of data was gathered between 2014 and 2015. Now, as I say, this is really opening up a whole load of interesting ideas. Some people say dark matter, dark energy doesn't exist. Some people say it does. And of course, there is a polite astronomical dust up over the truth. Now, this seems to be pushing the idea that this is actually a more correct idea, that dark matter does exist, and how it possibly may be working in the known universe. So I'm going to keep an eye on this, and I think we're going to be seeing a lot more stuff coming out of this story in the future. This story was actually published today, December the 1st, in Astronomy Now.
Mm-hmm. Well, the sculpture dwarf is actually a fairly round galaxy, kind of like a globular cluster. So, but doesn't look like it has a real defined core or anything like that. So the interesting part of how are the stars moving through there? Are they circling the center? Are they randomly traveling through there? So that's what kind of they're trying to study to determine what's actually making those stars move in the patterns that they're moving also.
Well, we're into the last 45 seconds of the show, folks.
We are.
So I guess it is time to start thinking about doing that.
Yeah.
Just got phased. Yeah, bye-bye, Redshirt. So, this is the away team to USS Miranda. 3 to beam up. Beam up Starstorm, myself, and Ensign Marty. Energize.
Thanks, everybody.
Good night, folks.
Appreciate you all listening in tonight. Thank everybody in chat. And don't forget, we got more programming coming up right after this program. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is astronomy.fm radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM. There I was, doing my thing, and all of a sudden, wham, astronomy right between the eyes.